Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone, and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have an amazing founder, you know, joining us. We're going to be talking about all the good stuff, you know, building, scaling, financing. I mean, on their end, you know, they've raised a lot of money. You know, they have employees globally distributed, and I think that we're going to be learning quite a bit, you know, about things like building a new category, how it was at a seed and Series A, given the fact how tough it was, how they navigated the challenges. Also, how to think about building a company in the enterprise SaaS, you know, type of segment, and many other, you know, really great things. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Kadeem Bhatti. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Alejandro. Pleasure to be here.
So originally born in Mumbai, in India, give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up for you?
So born and brought up in Mumbai, Maharashtra, state of Maharashtra in India. I did my schooling there. I was an average student to start with there, but was fascinated with computers and wanted to join in engineering. I couldn't get through in computer science, and I joined electrical engineering in Mumbai University, did that. After that, I worked for a year in hardware in Mumbai. Somehow wanted to keep switching, thinking that, okay, that's not the place I should be. I wanted to go into software, so I started appearing for post-graduation entrance exams. And got through Indian Institute of Information Technology at Bangalore University in Bangalore for my post-graduation. I quit my job after a year. I joined the IIIT Bangalore. That's how I moved to Bangalore, actually, from Mumbai. Did my post-graduation couple of years. And then from campus, I joined Huawei Telecom. Joined there initially building their network management system on 3G, 2G. And then later on switched to building business intelligence, a reporting platform. It became a full-fledged business intelligence product line, which I grew from few people to almost close to 100 people in research and development.
What was that transition for you too? Because at the beginning, you know, you were like more on the schooling, you know, towards perhaps hardware, and then all of a sudden you transitioned more, especially after your postgrad, to software. So what was that transition like for you?
Yeah, so as a hardware engineer, I used to get support calls like fixing some printer issues or configuring machines, configuring servers. And I used to see people actually working on doing some programming and all. So that created a lot of interest that I should be the other side, not this side. But it was not easy for an electrical engineer to get a job and switch to computer science. And that's where I started investigating further or researching further, like, okay, how do I switch my stream? And the best way I could find was to actually do my further studies, do my master's in computer science. And that was the easiest way or the best way I could think of. And during master's, actually, I really loved programming. I did a lot of programming in the first 1.5 years and went to deeper into data mining and some of those areas. Got my job in telecom. The first few months, I would say, went through a lot of calls, IEEE papers, and really went deeper into telecom, and then gradually after a couple of years, switched into business intelligence, got to the application layer, worked for 9 years there. That's where I met my co-founder as well. And then at some point realized that, okay, we have built a lot of products from scratch. Why not try something on our own? And that's how I came out and we started.
So you got started first with Search Enabler, and it was kind of like transitioning of events, you know, towards ending up with WhatFix. So what was that transition of events, you know, that happened there? You know, it seems like you guys thought that the market was going to be receptive towards, you know, one angle. And then all of a sudden, you know, you guys decide to pivot.
Yeah. So I think, it is very important to understand the context at that point. In 2011-12 timeframe, a lot of companies, small businesses were trying to leverage their online presence. Like everybody wanted to come online. And the second, another important aspect was there was a strong belief that companies which are getting from in India, which are startups which are coming out of India, they could actually cater globally only for smaller businesses because they can be done remote. For enterprise, you need to be present. So you need to be present in the geography, like US or Europe, wherever your customers are. Or you need to cater, or you need to build a startup which is catering to local India market. And with that assumptions, we started Search Enabler for solving or helping small businesses to leverage their social media presence, online presence, help them drive traffic from search engines. And we built that platform for, and thought we can scale to millions of small businesses. And that was the initial hypothesis which we launched. We tried that for 2.5-3 years. Things didn't move as expected. And the hypothesis was actually we would do a lot of crunching of data and give recommendations to the user saying, okay, what they need to fix in their website, how they should position their social media content and so on so that it can drive traffic. But that hypothesis didn't work because the business owners of us expected a lot more handholding to fix those issues or those recommendations. If they don't implement those recommendations, they would not see the ROI. And if they would churn. And we started seeing a lot of churn in few, like 6 to 8 months after sign up. The folks which were actually using our platform for a long term were SEO professionals, social media professionals, but that was not the target market we were looking for. We thought, okay, we need to make our product a lot more sales for the segment which we want to cater, that is small businesses. And while trying to solve that problem by giving them a lot of help material, giving them a lot of videos, we realized people were not reading all the stuff. They needed something in the flow of work. When actually they are doing the job, they need to get those tips and guidance, like how they should be fixing those issues or recommendations. And that's where we came up with a, you can say, bot fix as a feature or a byproduct, which was called Fixit. We used to have a button called Fixit in Search Enabler. When somebody clicks, it would show them help tutorials or take them to their WordPress or Joomla or Magento website and show them what they should do. Some of our customers came back to us saying that, okay, this sounds really cool. Can I use this for my customers so I can handhold them? It's like somebody is helping me over the shoulder, telling me what to do. We were two people company, me and my co-founders. We had to make a call that whether should we continue with Search Enabler or should we pivot to this new concept. We did a lot of Google and a lot of searches. We didn't find, we thought this is a disruptive, which can actually disrupt ticketing systems or learning management systems. And we thought, okay, let's pivot. So we brainstormed for 2 to 3 days. One thing was very clear, we cannot do both. We have to shut down one and accept another one. We gave a notice to 60, 70 paying customers of Search Enabler, returned money to most of the people, and then pivoted to WhatFix. That's how we started.
So then you guys also went through an accelerator program, right? GSF. So what was that experience of the before and after going through an accelerator program for you guys?
Yeah, so very important, Alejandro, like when we were thinking about working on WhatFix, it was very clear for us at that point that India is not going to be our market. If we want to build a large company of $100 million at least in revenue, we should target Europe and US market, primarily US. Both of us being programmer, engineering background, we had a zero exposure to sales and marketing, right? We didn't even know what are the different roles in those departments. So we thought we need to join something which can actually help us get some mentoring or some kind of workshops where we can learn and push our product, specifically in the geography which we want to be, like US. So GSF, we came across GSF, which was creating a cohort for 2 months in Bay Area. And we applied, we got through GSF. There were 11 companies in the cohort. We all were, initial first 1 month, we were in India doing a lot of workshops. Then for 2 months, we were in US. That was my first visit, even my co-founder's first visit to US. We spoke to a lot of founders, a lot of PROs, a lot of investors. It was a real eye-opener, like how companies can be built, how big the market is. And prior to that, we thought like $100 is a good price point, but then landing in US, we realized, no, we can sell much more. So that's how we got exposed to US market and actually looked at US as a primary market for us.
So then let's talk about what ended up becoming the business model of WhatFix, because I mean, it's been quite a journey for you guys.
Yeah. So we're primarily a software as a SaaS company. Initially, because it's a new category, there was no clear picker. So like, what should be the pricing model for our category? We tried a usage-based model, but then we faced a lot of friction from customers because they wanted very guaranteed payout. Like they should be able to estimate how much they're going to pay, which was very hard in our case because there were so many variant use cases. For example, I could sell to e-commerce company for handholding their affiliates. I can give it to banking for the corporate banking customers, which can be millions. Whereas I can even give it to SaaS companies for their enterprise customers or SMBs, or I can give it to large enterprise for the internal softwares on ERP, CLM. So there's too many variations where some places like consumer-facing software, millions of users, but the usage would be very less. Whereas in ERP, CRM, CLM, internal usage, number of users will be less, but the usage would be very high. So it was very hard to predict the usage base. So we gradually moved to seed-based model. And the second complexity was if I go to large enterprise, they would have typically thousands of software. We would start with one application like CRM or ERP something. So we would sell them one license for CRM for, let's say, 1,000 users. And then they would come back and say, okay, I need on ERP. I need on my HR software. I need on my CLM software and so on. So we started evolving that, how do I to sell on applications? Now, underlying application also differs. Like CRM typically is charging $100, $200 per user per month, whereas HR software is typically $10, $15, $20 per user per month. The reason also being like CRM, there are sales guys who have been working 4 or 5 hours every day on that software or ERP. Whereas HR software, travel software, people log in once or twice or thrice in a month. So how do we price on different applications? So we came up with a measurement saying, if it's a vertical software like CRM, CLMs, CPQ, or ERP, we want to charge like $3 to $5 per user per month. Where if it's a horizontal software, we're going to charge maybe $0.50 to $1. So in a way, we derive that we should be around 5 to 7% of underlying software price. So that's how our pricing also evolved. As we progressed further, there were a lot of large enterprises wanted to start expanding. Several companies started with one software, two software, then started implementing WattPix on 30, 40 softwares. And they also, the procurement started coming back to us. I don't want to raise POs and I don't want to keep buying licenses. Can I get a enterprise-wide agreement signed, or can I get a department-wide? Like, I have 50 softwares in my department. So we evolved, we removed that application variable. We said, okay, in your department, there are 5,000 users. This is my ELA for 5,000 users. You can use any number of applications internal to your organization. So that's how our pricing, our business model kept on evolving over a period of time.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
And also, how much capital have you guys raised to date?
Yeah, we raised close to $270 million so far.
And I know that the seed and Series A was quite challenging because you guys were literally leading the creation of a new category. So how was that for you all?
Yeah, so I think early days, there were a couple of problems. One, of course, this category was unknown. So the question we would get asked is like, is somebody going to pay for this? How much somebody is going to pay? How many people are going to pay for this? How big is the category? We also didn't know enough TAM. So in my initial estimation of TAM also was a couple of $100 million, because I thought only SaaS company is going to use this. Gradually, I realized this large enterprise market, I can go for internal tools and the TAM became several billions of dollars. So one was a TAM calculation, how much people are going to pay. Our pricing also evolved, like from few thousand dollars now, our average pricing is like $150,000 to $200,000 per year. So it was really difficult to actually articulate that or actually calculate those share of market or how we would evolve. Second, it was very unheard of in India that somebody can build a company, startup from India, which can sell to Fortune 500 or Global 1000 sitting out of India, right? Because there are several, there will be players locally who would compete and to be like, there would be a disadvantage. So most of the VCs used to believe to invest in the existing categories catering to small businesses or some very niche and all. So that was very hard sell early on. And third, also, there was also another belief that most of the investors at that point were going behind consumers, like we have Flipkarts or several large e-commerce companies and competitors to Ubers and all. There were a lot of investors coming from Japan or China or other countries investing in consumer market. So there were several investors also asking the question like, okay, we'll do seed round, we'll do Series A. Probably you will get Series B. Who would going to invest in a SaaS company in India for Series C, D? Eventually we'll have to go with US. But time has changed. Like today, we have seen examples in India where companies can raise seed and go to IPO in India in SaaS. So following a similar trajectory, I think we raised that Series A also was a challenge, but we had traction to demonstrate. Series D was a little bit confusing whether we should raise in India, we should raise in US. When we go to US, we were asked question like, okay, you are sitting 10,000 miles away. Do you want to invest companies in the locally? So those were the confusion. Post that Series C, D, E, we never had an issue. But there was a lot of numbers used to speak, traction used to speak. In fact, in C round and D round, I didn't even have a proper deck. And there was so much of pull from the market. And we were able to raise all this 270 million so far without having an investment banker. So both the founders, with the help of team, we were able to raise.
So it sounds like quite a journey. I mean, obviously, quite a bit of pivoting, you know, from one company to another, from one business model to another. At what point would you say that it was that moment where you were like, I think we're into something here. I think we're going to be okay.
Yeah, so we started with the small businesses, and then we started seeing churn. We got to a couple hundred thousand dollars, but churn was high, around 40% of the churn. There was no clear stickiness. There was no feel of, we were getting customers regularly, but there was no strong product market fit. So then we realized that, okay, we need to actually look for some other segment. And now enterprise segment, consumer-facing application, we also realized there are large companies, consumer companies or bankings. Their softwares need to be very simple enough for when they're facing the end users. We attended several events in the US, including Dreamforce and others, and we realized there's a big problem of ERPs or CRMs and all those large complex softwares in enterprises. And enterprises typically invest several hundreds of millions of dollars every year on software. And adoption is a challenge there. And we got first few customers in enterprise segment solving adoption problem for the software internally for their employees. I think that was kind of an year. That was a kind of an moment where we felt this can be made.
Now, in terms of enterprise SaaS, why is enterprise SaaS so hard? You know, what's about it that is so challenging and complex?
Yeah, so if you look at small businesses, I can reach out to a founder or one of the execs and share the value prop, what my product can offer, and sign a deal in a couple of thousand dollars, a few thousand dollars. Sales cycle will be pretty small. Whereas in enterprise, actually, there are several, it's not a single one-person decision, actually. Typically, there are a lot of people involved. Second, many of these decisions has to be budgeted earlier in their annual budgets, right? So it has to be carved out. If your category is new, where the budget would come from, it has to be snatched from somewhere else. So that makes it more complex. Then more departments get into it. Is this going to be secure for my enterprise? Like, do they have all the compliances? Is how easy it's going to be, how I'm going to deploy it? Is it going to be on cloud? Is it going to be on-premise, right? There has to be sign off from several CXOs or... So that cycle itself becomes like several months, including getting the budgets and all. Many companies want to do pilot. So that makes having multiple people in decision-making, having multiple departments involved, a lot of expectation in security, vendor registration, IT deployments makes it more complex.
So now let's talk about the vision here. You know, let's say, because I mean, you have a ton of employees. I mean, you have like over 900 employees, you know, all these investors. If you were to go to sleep tonight, and you wake up in a world, Kadeem, where the vision of the company is fully realized, what does that world look like to you?
Yeah. So one thing I have learned last few years, right? Like what you start with to solve actually keeps evolving. If it doesn't evolve, then as a company will at some point perish, right? So we started with a problem of helping software improve their adoption. We realized that's not a big enough problem. We need to flip. So we said, okay, can we make employees more productive? Now, suddenly it gives rise to requirements like, can I have a cross-application flows? Understanding the processes of what getting utilized in an organization, their friction points. So from a single adoption tool, we build analytics tool. And then we realize, okay, companies are spending several hundreds of millions of dollars on software. Can I give them perspective of what's working, what's not working? help them in making decisions? Can we help them realize the ROI of their software stack and give them different tools to improve their productivity of at organization level? So problem keeps evolving as we move. So maybe the short answer would be like when the day when I wake up and if I see that my vision is realized, probably I would not have done a good job in evolving my vision or the problem statement. But it lasts, for now, actually, what it looks like so far, it has always been accepted that users should become a tech savvy. You've been here, you would have heard several times, so we need to learn technology, we need to be tech savvy, right? But I think it's an era we are moving into where technology should become user savvy rather than user becoming tech savvy. And this philosophy we call userization. That's, we have written several white papers and we have coined this. So I believe at some point we want to userize every software in the world so that users can get the desired outcome and become very productive. Probably by then we should have evolved the problem statement much bigger.
And then talking about the vision here and aligning it with culture, right? I mean, you have all these different employees all across the world, you know, in different offices. How do you go about, you know, building culture and making sure that there's alignment towards that future that you guys are living into?
Yeah, so we were very conscious about it. Like, if you want to build a large company, we need to be, and it has to be global. So the culture also has to be accommodative and for employees across the world. So very clearly, we had articulated early on itself that we have one team concept. Doesn't matter whether somebody sitting in Bangalore or Delhi or London or Frankfurt or San Jose. So whoever is the best can lead the global teams. We also kept a culture of hustle mode on, that people should be very proactive. They should don't wait for others. They should proactively reach out, and everybody should be responding. Transparent communication. We share every number, every detail, what individual expects in our all hands. Doesn't matter where the person comes from, which geography, which function, which department. I think some of these things have helped us actually keep the teams together. Most of our leaders have been like here for now several years. So half of my leadership actually is sitting in India. Another half is sitting in US and Europe. So it's a collective global leadership.
So now let's say I was to put you into a time machine. Can I bring you back in time? You know, maybe to that moment that you were thinking about launching something of your own, you know, maybe like 14 years ago. And let's say you're able to have a chat with that younger Kadeem and give that younger self one piece of advice for launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
Yeah, so I would not have those assumptions, which I had heard from different people saying SMB is not going to work from India. This is new category is going to be hard. I would not have all those assumptions. And I would actually directly look at what's the right segment for this particular problem and go for it. I would have achieved product market fit pretty early, probably maybe 3-4 years in my journey I would have saved. And I would have probably reached several milestones much earlier.
And what about coming to the US? You know, there's probably a lot of foreign founders that are thinking about tackling this market and, you know, expanding here. I mean, what kind of words of wisdom would you have for them?
Yeah, so we have around 65% of our market in US today, right? So to build team and to have a good presence in the geography, you need to also align to the local culture and build a team and get the right talent or attract talent there. Very hard if all the founders are remote. So I would suggest two or three co-founders, one of them actually preferably should move. Like one, I think as soon as we crossed a couple of $1 million in revenue, my co-founder moved to US and he started helping build the team locally. That really worked out for us.
That's amazing, Kadeem. So for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Yeah, they can reach out on me on LinkedIn. My email, I'm generally responsive, kadeem@whatfix.com. If they want to evaluate WhatFix or check it out, whatfix.com, or reach out to us at sales@whatfix.com.
Amazing. Well, easy enough. Well, hey, Kadeem, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
It was my pleasure, Alexander, to communicate. Hope I think I was able to share some of the learnings. Thank you.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.